The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week we're looking at the science of language. What makes humans good at it? Why do so many languages share common features? And are humans the only animals that have learned how to use it? My first guest is noted linguist, philosopher, author, and activist Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor and Professor Emeritus in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at MIT. Professor Chomsky is the author of over 100 books, including some of the most important texts in modern linguistics, as well as extensive social, political, and media criticism. Wonderful to have you here, Professor Chomsky.
Glad to be with you.
Now, you're often referred to as a nativist when it comes to language, primarily for your universal grammar hypothesis. Can you outline for me what UG is?
First of all, the term nativism is one that's only used by critics of what they think nativism is, whatever it is.
Interesting.
I never use it. If you take a look at language, for example, if you take a newborn human infant and a newborn chimpanzee or kitten or whatever, and you put them in exactly the same environment, the human infant will reflexively extract from the complex environment data which are human language related, and then also pretty reflexively proceeds through a series of developmental stages and ends up with this capacity that we have. On the other hand, the, say, chimpanzee, which has approximately the same auditory system, just hears noise. Well, there are two possibilities. Either it's a miracle, or else there's some genetically determined property of humans which directs and guides this process. So I assume it's not a miracle. So therefore, there's some human-specific genetic endowment, which as far as we know has no counterpart in other organisms. And if there is such an endowment, then we can try to discover a theory of it to explain it. That's called universal grammar, UG.
Well, would you describe your approach to language as being biological?
Sure. I assume that our language capacity is effectively a biological organ, a property mostly of the brain, of some specific kinds of neural organization, which enter into, again, what you and I are now doing and also how we got to this stage.
Well, one distinction you make in your work is between the I language and the E language. Can you tell us a bit about that distinction and, I guess, specifically why it's important to understanding universal grammar?
Well, I actually did invent the terms, but they're typically not used in the way I defined them, so I feel a little odd about it. By I language, I just mean whatever the system is that I've internalized. That's my I language. What you've internalized is your I language. They're more or less, they're pretty similar, not identical, but they're similar enough so that we can interact the way we're doing now. It's like the state of your visual system. The state of your visual system and the state of my visual system are not identical because of partly there might be some minor genetic differences, but mainly there's experiential differences which shape the growth and development of it. There could be an account of your visual system would be the counterpart to I language, similar to mine but not identical, even more different from someone who's a native speaker of Swahili, let's say. E-language, I defined it as just anything else. And as I said, I don't think there's another coherent notion. What people use the term for is something like what's called a corpus, a collection of expressions. You take a Google search of the Wall Street Journal, you'll get a huge number of sentences that appeared. Well, some people refer to that kind of thing as an e-language. I don't think it's a meaningful notion.
Well, as you know, there are many linguists that disagree with the universal language hypothesis. So would you be able to walk me through sort of what their main arguments are against it?
their main arguments have to be misunderstanding, because, as I just described, the hypothesis is that we're not angels, we're organisms. If we're organisms, then there has to be what I just described. We can ask what it is, we can ask to what extent do elements of the human language capacity also appear in other cognitive systems, maybe in other organisms, but that there is a genetic basis for it. It just seems so far beyond debate that I don't see how there can be a discussion. Quite often the linguists you're referring to misunderstand the term universal grammar. What they often mean is generalizations that are largely true of language. And there are some interesting generalizations which are largely true, you know, not 100%, but substantially true. Some of the most important were proposed by the linguist, a very good, famous and important linguist, Joseph Greenberg, called the Greenberg Universals. And they're very interesting because, like other generalizations, they're not always true. You know, there's too many factors that enter in. But to the extent that they're true, it's interesting to try to explain why they're true. And when we try to explain why they're true, we're back to universal grammar in the other sense. What is the fixed genetic capacity that plays out under various circumstances to lead to these consequences? But I don't know of any coherent critique of what universal grammar actually means, and don't see how there could be one other than saying, well, humans are not part of the biological world.
I guess the main difference is that the other linguistic theories argue that language is an entirely learned behavior, right?
No, but it can't be entirely learned. That one reason is that if you take a look at actual examples, what's learned has absolutely no data to support it. Another is if it were just other cognitive capacities, then you wouldn't find the sharp dissociations that have been discovered. So it's by now well known that highly competent, maybe perfect language capacity can be quite sharply dissociated from other cognitive abilities, dissociations in both directions, incidentally. Also, it would be astonishing that other organisms, say with similar auditory systems or virtually identical ones, can't even make the first step, let alone later ones. But that doesn't indicate that there's nothing in the human language capacity that doesn't also show up somewhere else. Of course there is, but the same is true of our visual system. You take a close look at the mammalian visual system, human visual system, you'll find elements of it which appear in other systems. That's the way biology works. But that doesn't stop people from trying to discover what it is that leads to a mammalian rather than an insect visual system. And it's only in the case of the study of language or higher mental faculty, what are called higher mental faculties generally, that this kind of general scientific rationalism is abandoned for some reason.
Well, speaking of data, it's now nearing 57 years since the publication of your book, Syntactic Structures. So between your first theories and now, has the evidence changed?
Oh, yeah, enormously. I mean, for one thing, there's been a huge explosion of inquiry into language by any measure that you take, journals, departments, number of students. There's been just an incredible escalation, sharper than any time before in the last couple of thousand years of study of language, much sharper. So an enormous amount of evidence is now available, which wasn't then, and a very wide variety of languages, most of which had never been studied. And the questions that are being asked are much more penetrating. I mean, the kinds of questions that, say, students are working on today, you couldn't even have formulated 60 years ago. And, of course, as progress is made, new problems emerge, which is exciting and interesting and the sign of a field that's alive and growing. So the approaches I suggested back in the 1950s were extremely complex and intricate, I understood, and a few others who were involved understood that it couldn't be correct, because if it were correct, the acquisition of the I language, the system, would be inconceivable, and of course, the evolution of it would be totally inconceivable. So there's been the thrust of theoretical work, at least the kind that I'm interested in, has been to try to show that the apparent complexity is a superficial phenomenon, and that if we search deeper, we can find more fundamental principles that explain the major parts of it and show that the other parts are due to other factors, and also that will give us some way of some handle on the new discoveries that are being made about general properties of language and the course of acquisition, and to the limited extent that we have evidence, the neural basis and so on. The field's just exploded in all kinds of directions.
When we turn our attention to evolution, you've been characterized in the past as being skeptical of evolutionary explanations of the language faculties. So do you think that evolutionary or adaptive explanations can be helpful at all to us in the study of language?
The fact of the matter is that I'd prefer to keep to what is actually understood about evolutionary biology and not indulge in what evolutionary biologists dismiss as just-so stories, mm-hmm. stories they invent, like maybe it happened this way, maybe it happened that way. I'm not interested in that. But first of all, let's clarify the question. There is no such topic as evolution of language. Languages don't evolve. They change, but they don't evolve. What evolves is the language capacity. That's part of our biological nature. And that, of course, has evolved. And it's evolved in Homo sapiens, but not, as far as we know, in other hominids. There's no evidence that any of them, there were many of them, had anything like the capacity. And there's nothing like it in other organisms. And one of the reasons why the neurophysiology of language is such a difficult topic is that ethical considerations prevent invasive experimentation with humans, which you can easily imagine. It could answer a lot of questions, but it's ruled out. And there just is no relevant comparative evidence. So in the case of the visual system, a lot is known about the neurophysiology of the human visual system by experimentation with cats and monkeys. But you can't do that in the case of language because there's no other organism to study. So something developed, obviously it evolved by definition, that's what evolution is, but it's a language capacity. Well, what do we know about it? What we know with high confidence is that ever since our ancestors began to depart East Africa, which is usually dated roughly 60,000 years ago, since that time, where humans have proliferated all over the world, there has been no detectable evolution of the language capacity. And what that means is that if you, say, take a child from an Amazonian tribe that hasn't had other contact for, you know, tens of thousands of years, then you bring it to, say, Boston as an infant, it'll speak just like my grandchildren, and conversely. The evidence for that is pretty overwhelming. So there's good reason to believe that the language capacity has not evolved, which is not too surprising. 60,000 years isn't a long time. That's what we know with high level of confidence. What we can speculate with a fair level of confidence is that if you go back not very much farther, maybe 50 or 100,000 years, there's no evidence that there was any language capacity at all. So it looks as though somewhere in that window, which is a tiny window from an evolutionary point of view, it's a, you know, it's a flick of an eye, something happened, something emerged, which led to cognitively modern Homo sapiens, anatomically modern hominids, maybe call them Homo sapiens if you like, existed long before, maybe hundreds, thousands of years before. But there seems to have been some cognitive breakthrough roughly 100,000 years ago or maybe less, which shows up in the archaeological record with, in many ways, evidence of complex social structures, of complex symbolism, notations for annotating astronomical events, complicated burial practices, all sorts of things which are generally assumed plausibly to be associated with the emergence of language. That's about all we know. Anything beyond that is fairy tales that people invent. Well, if you look at that closely, you can make some proposals as to what kind of an event would have taken place. Presumably, some might be quite small reorganization of the neural system, which yielded the fundamental properties of language that we now can reasonably take to be the core of universal grammar in the technical sense that I mentioned, not the sense that's often used. And there's a fair amount of work on what that might have been and how it could have developed and so on. Kind of, again, in the flick of an eye, very sudden emergence, which is not surprising from a biological point of view. I mean, contrary to a lot of misunderstanding, things like that do happen in evolutionary history, and this seems to be one of them. It happened to lead to a very dramatic development, Homo sapiens, and language, which, as I mentioned, really have no serious counterparts. And there's some analogs elsewhere, but nothing like a close counterpart. So that's about what we know about evolution of language. Now, this is described by in the literature, what you're referring to, as a critique of evolution of language, but it's not. It's just analysis of the evolution of the language capacity based on whatever evidence we have and whatever insight we have into the nature of language.
You've mentioned speculation a lot. And so what kind of research would we have to do, barring, you know, the hugely unethical ones? What kind of research would we have to do? What types of evidence would help us understand this?
It'd be nice to find tape recordings from 100,000 years ago, but we're not going to find them.
Right. You know, I want to go back to something that you sort of mentioned. Do you find evolutionary explanations can be at all helpful in areas outside biology?
I mean, that's kind of a metaphor. I mean, evolution means basically genomic change. Cultures certainly change. Languages change. Maybe there's some suggestive analogies between the changes in culture and the evolution of organisms. Clearly, that's analogy. English didn't evolve from Old English or Old Norse. It changed from them, which is a very different matter. All of us, you and I and the kind of people you're reaching, take for granted that organisms evolve. And they evolve roughly in the Darwinian sense, though now a lot more is known, of course. And of course, there's not only a place for it, it's crucial to the study of organisms. But we shouldn't confuse change through history with evolution of organisms.
Professor Chomsky, thank you very much for being here. And it was wonderful to talk to you.
Yep, glad to talk to you.
You'll find a link to Professor Noam Chomsky and his work on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to get a different take on the structure of language with anthropologist Terence Deacon right after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
This is Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and my next guest is Terence Deacon, Anthropology Department Chair at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Deacon's research has combined human evolutionary biology and neuroscience with the aim of investigating the evolution of human cognition. He's the author of The Symbolic Species, The Co-Evolution of Language and the Brain. Thanks for being here, Terry.
Thank you.
Now, I just had Noam Chomsky on to talk about the universal grammar hypothesis. So can I get your take on it before we get started?
Well, there's two parts to it that I think need to be taken separately. The first is there something universal about human languages? And I think most linguists agree that there is. Exactly what universality means is probably a more complicated question. And I think the simplest way to say it is that languages around the world, and those that sort of even evolve very, very short term, for example, in deaf communities and so on, all share a number of attributes alike. They all have things like sentences. They all have things that play a kind of noun and verbish kind of role. They have lots of structure internally that allows certain things and doesn't allow other things. I basically agree with the notion that there is a universal underlying feature to language. What I have trouble with, and I think this is what complicates the story, is whether or not it's universal because of biology, because of some accident of evolution, or some selection process in evolution that made it necessarily this way. I think this gets back to a troublesome issue that's always been around. And that is the nature-nurture dichotomy. Is language mostly nature? Is language mostly nurture? I happen to think that there's a third alternative that is missed in this discussion. What I would say is that the universals of language, at least some of them, are neither the result of nature nor nurture. The analogy I would give to this is in mathematics. Consider something like prime numbers. What I would say is that any intelligent life that develops any kind of way of regularizing, working with quantities anywhere in the universe, they will discover at some point that there are numbers that cannot be divided by anything but themselves and one. Prime numbers are therefore not innate, and they're not merely the result of some cultural convention. There's some kind of constraint in the way we represent and operate on quantity that forces them to be there. I think that there are many universals of language are like that. They're discovered whenever languages develop.
Okay, so I haven't heard that one. And I'll be honest, before I started researching for this show, I didn't realize that the evolution of language was such a controversial topic, and there were so many hypotheses about it. So why is it so controversial?
It's controversial in part because it stands out as something that really makes the human species distinctive from all other species. Communication is something that all animals, one way or another, they become involved in that kind of exchange of information about themselves and about the world around them. We can sort of metaphorically call all of that language, but in fact, language has so many distinctive traits that it makes it stand out in comparison to these. Even more interestingly, from the point of view of a neuroscientist like myself, language is controlled in our brains in a way that's radically different than the way other kinds of communications, vocal communications, are controlled. So, for example, we can recognize in you and I that we do have innate forms of communication that we were born with, a laughter, sobbing, shrieks of fright, and so on. And many, many species have these. But these are all controlled by very different parts of the brain than language. And so in the evolution of language, there's a couple of things that make language special. One of them is that it has these different kinds of structures that we just don't find in other species, grammar and syntax, which Noam Chomsky is, of course, focused on. But they're also controlled by parts of the brain that are very, very different and do different things. And so that makes language a kind of threshold that distinguishes human beings from other species.
Well, maybe it's easier to talk about what anthropologists do agree on in regards to the evolution of language. Does everybody agree on at least a couple of things?
I think that there is broad agreement about what I just said about the distinctiveness of linguistic features. I think there is growing agreement that it's not a bright line that distinguishes humans from other species. I think we're beginning to find out that there are some language-like functions that other species can figure out and can use. Our ability to vocalize is very distinctive. And I would say that most anthropologists recognize, most biologists recognize that our vocal capacities are really distinctive among other species of mammals. So I would say that anthropologists will agree that some point in the last, and typically it almost always falls in with the last 2 million years at the most, these distinctive abilities have developed separately in our species. Now, to say that they've developed can be interpreted in lots of different ways, depending on how you view what's unique about language. But I think everyone would agree that we have certain, you might say, adaptations, certain facilities that make language much more easy to acquire and use in our species and that are not there in other species.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is Terrence Deacon, Anthropology Department Chair at the University of California, Berkeley. Now, I guess one of the big problems with research in this field is the lack of empirical evidence.
The problem, of course, is that nothing about language fossilizes.
Right.
Not even brains fossilize. So that puts us at a real disadvantage. On the other hand, I think the field is breaking open, in part because we have new tools to look at this prehistory through its modern counterparts in terms of anatomy of the brain that we can look at, comparing human brains to, say, primate brains, and the genetics, looking at human genetics compared to the genetics of other species, and particularly trying to identify genes that are distinctive of human beings and that play some role in the structure of our brains. By gathering this kind of information, we can, so to speak, triangulate back to how the brains of other species were operating, whether they in fact had certain facilities or not, say, for example, to produce articulate vocalization and so on.
Can you talk about some of that research?
In terms of brains, for example, we clearly know that human brains are considerably larger for the bodies that they exist in. We have brains that are about 3 times what you'd expect for a typical primate of our body size. We don't really know what it means to have a larger brain for your body. But we do suspect that that change in the brain, which is so distinctive of our species compared to other species, almost certainly has something to do with our cognitive capacities, and probably the most astounding of those, of course, is language. So size of the brain matters, and we're beginning to look at, by comparing connectivity in brains and regional sizes, that is the sizes of the various parts of the brain, which we can do across species, getting some idea as to what expanded, what didn't expand, and as we understand the genetics of development, what changed to make those things change. And one of the things that we're finding is that human brains are not just blown up primate brains, like blowing up a balloon, that just everything gets bigger at once. Some things get bigger, other things don't. And the connections between those regions, which in a sense like the connections within a computer, are what make the functions happen. And those connections are also affected by relative size and other genetic factors. And we do now know that there are some connections that are clearly different in human brains, so that it's not just the relative sizes of the parts that matters, but the connections are also different. All of these things are providing clues as to what happened. So, for example, it's now fairly well understood that we human beings have a fairly direct connection between our cerebral cortical areas that control motor skills and the connection to the nucleus in our brainstem that controls the movements of the muscles of our larynx. Other species of land animals don't seem to have that kind of a direct connection. As a result, we can hold tone, we can arbitrarily learn skills of sound production and stopping and starting sound with the movements of our mouth in coordination that other species of land mammals simply can't. The exception, of course, are animals like birds, like parrots, and so on, that can do this, but they actually use a very, very different anatomy to do the same thing. There are also now interesting findings genetically that suggest things have changed. So, for example, one of the most recent and exciting findings, although it has not panned out to be quite as dramatic as it was once thought, is that a particular gene called FOXP2 seems to be associated with articulate speech production. It was originally thought to have something to do with grammar and syntax, though now it's mostly thought not to have that effect. Nevertheless, one of the things that stands out about us is our ability to do what I'm doing right now, speak and rapidly control the articulation of my tongue, my lips, my jaw, and my larynx, and my diaphragm to produce language. FOXP2 seems to play a role in that. Now, FOXP2 turns out to be a very old gene in the sense that we can find homologs to that gene even in fruit flies. But within mammals, it's fairly conserved. It doesn't vary a lot, which suggests it's doing a fairly standard and important function in terms of organizing brains for, we think, probably motor function. But what we do know is that in humans, initially this was identified because a family who had inherited damage to this gene had real problems with articulating speech. And so when the gene was finally isolated, it was very interesting to find that human beings all share a particular version of that gene that's different from most other mammals. It differs by only a few tiny changes, but the fact that all human beings share this and other primates don't stood out as saying that maybe this is something that has evolved also in humans to make language, in a sense, more capable. We can produce the kinds of vocalizations that are necessary to acquire language. Now, are there other genes that are going to be associated with this? Undoubtedly, as we go into the process of understanding how genes build brains and how brains are critical for language and what parts of brains are, we're going to discover more and more about this.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but those are all biological pieces of evidence. What's the learned side? What's the cultural aspect?
The non-nature-nurture part is what I call semiotic constraints. It's a somewhat radical view, and I don't think it's widely shared, that once we communicate symbolically with these arbitrary forms of sound or gesture or whatever we've produced that get put into sentences to communicate about other things in the world, there are certain constraints that are there. One of the questions is, why do all languages have things like sentences that have noun and verb parts that are about picking things out in the world and assigning a name or a value or a quality to them? So, for example, I could produce the word noise. You can think about what it means and so on. But if I do this, noise, suddenly noise now refers to those funny sounds I just produced. And what's happened is that I have produced what's called in semiotic theory an index. I've effectively pointed to something. The problem is that symbols, like the word noise, refer to each other. Noise refers in the opposite to signal, refers to things that you might hear outside. There's all kinds of things. In effect, noise doesn't refer to anything in particular. It is a place in what we sometimes call a semantic network, a network of meanings. The problem is, if you want to refer with something abstract like that, that's just referring to other abstract things, you need to link it outside of that network of meanings. And so an index is a way we do it. So if I say here at home, hot, I could refer to the temperature in the surround simply because it's the most obvious index that I could apply to it. But, of course, if I touched my finger to some surface and pulled it back and said rapidly and said hot, you'd know I was referring to that in particular. The structure of a sentence is limited. In order to use symbols to communicate about things in the world, we need to couple them to an indexical activity. And indices, pointings, have certain constraints. They have to be, in a sense, coupled with, correlated with in time or space, with whatever they're referring to. So you can't point to things that simply aren't here unless you use something like language. That's a constraint that I think we inherit simply because we're using symbols in the way that you inherit certain constraints in mathematics. There are all kinds of other constraints that can produce quasi or semi-universals in language as well. We have certain problems in communicating with one another. We have to take turns. We have to get information. We have to provide information. We have to demonstrate whether we have experienced something directly or indirectly. All kinds of things that go on. Those are universals that are much more cultural, have to do with communication. There are universals that could easily have to do with simply our limits of memory. A sentence can't be too long or too complicated or we get lost. It can't have too many sub-clauses or we don't know what refers to what. And in fact, we can't pull the indexical parts, the pointing parts, away from the symbolic parts without getting confused about what we're talking about. So there's a lot of limitations like that that are probably contributing to the universals of language. So I see the universals of language as a nested hierarchy of constraints. You know, there's some constraints that are semiotic, there's some constraints that are communicative, there's some constraints that are local to a culture, there's some constraints that have to do with our memory limitations or our perceptual limitations. All of these are going to limit the realm of how language can vary. Constraints that if we're going to communicate, we basically have to act within those limitations.
If you are correct, and language is sort of a combination of nature and nurture, does that provide more evidence for certain species having language as opposed to communication, or does it reduce the likelihood?
I think the problem is the way we use the concept of language as though it's some absolute category. The way I've described it, it's the convergence of lots of different factors. Some of them are semiotic. Some of them are processing factors in terms of what brains can or can't do, what sounds can and can't do. All of those contribute to what we call language. So if we stop thinking about language as something that is either present or absent, we have no trouble beginning to see aspects of those same phenomena in other species. No other species has all of these features. Are there some that are absolutely more critical to what we define as language? I think some are. For example, the semiotic constraints that I talked about. So, for example, although many other species use different sounds or gestures to refer to specific states of their own bodies or minds or to specific things in their environment, none of them appear to use this combinatorial trick that I was just talking about, where you put together a symbol, an arbitrarily produced reference marker, and an index, a way to link that arbitrary and abstract thing to something in the world. They don't seem to do those together. There's nothing quite like a sentence that's produced. And that, I think, goes strongly to Noam Chomsky's perspective. That is, that this, what we might call the basis of grammar, the ability, the combinatorial power of language, seems not to be what we find in the rest of the world. It's not that that other species can't be brought to do some bits of it. It's an accumulation of capacities. And so rather than talking about the language device in the brain or the language mutation that made it all possible, I like to think about our evolution as made up of a long series of adaptations, each of which makes some aspect of the language problem easier for us to acquire and easier for us to produce.
Terry, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
And you can find a link to Terence Deacon on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Khan Slobodchikov to talk about animal language after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're learning about the search for strange and exotic life forms in outer space, in overlooked corners on Earth, and even deep within our own tissues. We'll speak to David Toomey, director of the Program for Professional Writing and Technical Communication at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, about his book Weird Life, the search for life that is very, very different from our own. And ethicist and futurist George Dvorsky returns to the show to discuss the ethical issues raised by contacting a non-human intelligent species. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
I'm here today with Khan Slobodchikov, Professor Emeritus of the Department of Biological Sciences at Northern Arizona University and President and CEO of Animal Communications Limited. Kahn's work with prairie dog language has been featured in the Smithsonian Magazine, National Geographic, and Discover Magazine, among others. He's the author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. Very good to have you here, Kahn.
Thank you, Desiree. Good to be here.
So let's start out by talking about just how controversial a topic animal language is. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being there is a scientific consensus, and 10 being no one agrees on anything and would everyone kindly stop yelling. Where are we at?
It depends on whether you're talking about scientists or you're talking about the general public. I would say that among scientists, it is definitely a 10. Everybody disagrees, and in fact, most people say that animals are not capable of language. All they're capable of doing is communicating. Right. Now, when you talk to people in the general public, they say, why, of course, we always knew that animals have language. So what's the big deal? But in my book, I have used only evidence from the scientific literature. I've not used anecdotal stories from pet owners. I've not used stories that I've read on the internet. It all comes from the scientific journals. And I wanted to do it this way because in working with the language of prairie dogs, I saw that we actually have quite a bit of evidence in the scientific literature that other animal species have language. So I started to explore this. And in my book, Chasing Dr. Doolittle, I use something like 250 different references of animals using what can be interpreted as language. Now, the authors of these papers have not called that language. They've talked about communication. But if you look at it from the standpoint of language, it surely is language. And so I wrote the book to look at all of this evidence. But at the same time, I didn't want this to be a completely scientific book, which would be read by maybe 30 people or so. I wanted it to be something that could be read by everybody who was interested in animals. So I wrote it in a very popular style, a very friendly, open style. And I put in lots of my own anecdotes of my own experiences with animals and how I saw language at work in these animals.
So maybe let's go back a step, because I don't believe that we've defined what language is exactly, and that's part of the controversy.
It is part of the controversy, and everybody has different definitions of language. The way that I look at language is that language has 4 criteria that I think are important. One is flexibility. In other words, the animal has a toolbox of signals that the animal can choose to decide to use for a given situation. So the animal is not locked into a stimulus response kind of thing, which is the way that I view communication. In communication, a message comes in and you press one button and another message goes out, and it's always the same message for the same button. So we have flexibility. Then we have intentionality, that the animal actually intends to send a message. So it's not like it's an instinctive kind of response, that every time a particular stimulus comes in, the animal always puts out the other stimulus without any intention to put out the stimulus or even realizing that there's any stimulus or any response going out. Then there's novelty, the ability of animals to use or manufacture novel stimuli. And we see this in our words. Cell phone, as an example, probably would not have meant anything to anybody 50 years ago. So the animal is capable of producing novel signals in novel kinds of situations. And finally, there's structure, which is some kind of grammatical structure, or some kind of coherent way that all of these signals are put together. So we have our grammars, lizards have distinct patterns of their grammars where they move, or in certain situations, they move their legs in different patterns. They lift their head up in different patterns. They lift their tail up in different patterns to communicate different kinds of information. So those are the four criteria that I see as being important for language.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest today is Khan Slobodchikov. He's the author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. So a bunch of what you said there is obviously controversial. So the studies that have been done in this field are often fairly open to interpretation, right?
They are, yes.
Why is that?
There's several reasons for this. One reason is that in science, the paradigm that you use sometimes determines the kind of experiment that you're going to carry out and, to a certain extent, the kind of result that you're going to get. If you assume that an animal is not capable of language, you're not going to design an experiment which is going to test for language ability. You might design a more narrower focus experiment, which might give you results which would suggest perhaps communication taking place. It could suggest language, but since you're working in the communication paradigm, you interpret the results as communication and not as language. Science tends to be very paradigm driven, and scientists are sometimes reluctant to step outside of an established paradigm to embrace another paradigm or to look at evidence from another paradigm because of a variety of factors. There's disapproval from their colleagues. They tend not to get tenure if they're not looking at the right paradigms. They don't get grant funds. So there's a variety of factors that go into a reluctance to interpret things in different ways.
Well, and another barrier to providing good evidence is the animal itself. So maybe could you talk about the challenges of trying to study animal languages in a lab?
In the ideal sort of scientific method, you have a hypothesis and you set up an experiment and you have maybe 100 different, quote, subjects who all will respond the same way. Or alternatively, you could ask one subject 100 questions and ideally that subject will respond, if not exactly the same way, at least most of the responses are going to be very similar or the same. So then you do a statistical test, and the statistical test will tell you whether the responses that you get are entirely random and there's no statistical significance, or whether the responses are statistically significant according to criteria that are well established in the scientific literature. But with animals, particularly with intelligent animals, you tend not to get the same responses. So, for example, if I showed you something that was yellow and round, and I expected you to say melon, and you would look at that and you might say ball. Well, that's a perfectly legitimate response, but it's not what I expect. So that counts as a wrong answer. So the next time, you might say rubber circle. Again, that might be a perfectly legitimate response, but again, it counts as a wrong answer. And so you go on, and maybe you get tired of saying one word, so you'll say the thingy that I have no idea what it is, and I have no idea what it is that you're asking me about, but there it is. And that counts as a wrong answer, too. And then maybe after a while, you get bored with the same answer and you, the next time around, say absolutely nothing. And that counts as a wrong answer. So pretty soon we've accumulated a whole bunch of wrong answers that you've given to the expectation of the experimenter that you would somehow say melon. So that's really a challenge as far as the scientific method goes and as far as applying the scientific method to these kinds of experiments is how do we design experiments that will take into account the intelligence of animals, take into account their linguistic ability, take into account the variation of responses that they're going to perhaps produce, and at the same time test our hypothesis. And that's a real challenge.
It sounds like you find science very lacking.
No, not at all. Okay. I think that science is a very powerful method. And I think that science has gotten us a very long way from where we would have been if we would have just been looking at the clouds and trying to figure out what the gods are telling us. So I think that science gives us a very strong tool for finding out about the world, and it also provides a certain level of objectivity in that, theoretically at least, you can do the same experiment that I can do and theoretically come up with the same results in most cases. And I at least can't think of a better system. So I'm not against science per se, but what I am saying is that the tools that we have right now for studying animal intelligence and animal language aren't really the best that we have. We have to be very clever in terms of figuring out how we can apply some of these scientific methods given the variability that we're likely to encounter.
So now you have put all of this into practice by studying prairie dogs. Can I ask, first of all, why prairie dogs?
Prairie dogs for me were kind of an accident because when I came to Northern Arizona University, I was expected to do research as part of my professorship. And I started working with beetles that produce defensive secretions. These beetles squirt these defensive secretions out of their anus. And the beetles also do a headstand when they're disturbed. And so I had some beetles with secretions in my lab. And one day I walked into my lab, took a deep breath, and my lungs started filling with fluid. And I realized this is a very bad sign because it meant that I had gotten allergic to the secretions. So it was a dilemma for me because I still needed to have a research program. So at the time around Flagstaff, there were a lot of prairie dogs, and these prairie dogs are social colonial animals that live in colonies, and there were a lot of colonies around my university. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting for me to look at the social behavior of these prairie dogs, which at that time was relatively unknown? And in the process of looking at the social behavior, I saw that they had alarm barks, which they gave for predators. And I had read at that time that some people with other ground squirrels had found that these other ground squirrels had one type of alarm bark for terrestrial predators like coyotes and dogs and badgers, and another type of alarm bark for aerial predators such as hawks and eagles. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to see if these prairie dogs have two types of alarm barks? So I started recording the alarm barks and found that, yes, I could sort them into two types of alarm barks, but there's still a lot of variation in the terrestrial barks and the aerial barks. And I started to wonder, why is there that much variation? At that point, we found that individual prairie dogs had their own distinctive voices, but that didn't account for the amount of variation that we saw. So I had kind of an intuition that what if they are actually describing or having words for individual predators? So I set up experiments where we recorded different predators coming by and analyzed the vocalizations and found that, sure enough, they do have different words for different predators. So they have one word for coyote, another word for domestic dog, another word for a human, another one for a hawk, another one for a badger. But there was still a lot of variation. The variation had dropped, but there is still a disturbing amount of variation in there that I couldn't explain. And so I had another intuitive hunch. I thought, what if, by chance, they are describing the physical features of the individual predators? So we set up experimental situations. And here I have to say that I was really fortunate because these prairie dogs, being colonial, They live in colonies. The colonies never go anywhere, so I could come back day after day to exactly the same colony. We marked the individuals with fur dye, so we knew who all the individuals were. And the individuals never went anywhere, unlike, say, monkeys or whales or other animals that move from place to place, and you can't find them on a day-to-day basis. With these animals, they were always there. And so I set up experiments where we walked humans through that differed in size and shape. We walked dogs through that differed in size and shape and coat color. We dressed humans in different colored shirts. We had the same human wear a blue shirt one time, a yellow shirt another time, and analyzed all of these calls and found that, sure enough, then we could find statistically significant differences between all of these factors. So with a human, for example, there were statistically significant differences between humans who were thin and humans who were not thin, humans who were tall and humans who were short, humans who wore a yellow shirt versus humans who wore a blue shirt.
Well, now, how did you analyze that exactly, those calls?
What we did was we recorded all of the calls in the field. Then we brought them back into the laboratory where we had a computer program which analyzed the calls in terms of putting up on the screen a picture of all of the frequencies and time elements in the call. So then we measured the changes in frequency and time in different parts of the call, put this into a computer program that analyzed statistically whether the changes in frequency and time, say for coyotes, was the same as or different from the frequency and time changes in domestic dogs. And because we had at least 100 animals in a colony, and we did this over multiple colonies, we had a large sample size, so we could analyze this statistically, and the statistics told us that, yes, indeed, the frequency and time changes for coyote calls were statistically different from the frequency and time changes for domestic dog calls or for human calls. And then we did the same thing with colored shirts and people's sizes and shapes and so on.
Have these studies been replicated?
In the sense of somebody from another lab replicating it, no. But I was not convinced at any step along the way that our initial results were correct. So I replicated this a number of times over different years and over different field seasons just to prove to myself that we're finding something that was consistent and true. Various people have asked me for information about how to do this. But the thing to keep in mind is that this is an incredibly labor-intensive project.
Right. So now this is still a field that is somewhat, to a certain extent, in its infancy. Why are people so resistant to doing this kind of research?
When I was a graduate student, anthropology texts quaintly said, man, the tool user, that was what defined us as different from all the other animals. Well, once people started looking, we found that lots of other animals make tools and make very sophisticated tools. So then the thing was that humans were the only ones with culture. No other animal had culture. And then once we started looking, we found that lots of other animals had culture, and in some cases, very sophisticated culture. So now we're left with this barrier of language. People are saying, well, we humans are special because we have language and no other animal has language. And if that breaks down, in some people's mind, what does that do in terms of our specialness?
You know, I'm not sold, but I really want to be. So I would like you all to get a lot of money and you can do tons of research because this is, I don't mind not being a special snowflake, and I'd like to know a lot more about animal cognition. So, Con, lovely to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Desiree.
And you can find a link to Kon Slobodchikov, author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And while you're there, click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, where you can keep up on show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.